Good afternoon, and welcome to today's program on International Financial Regulation, presented by the Securities and Exchange Commission Historical Society, and broadcast on www.sechistorical.org. I'm Teresa Gabaldone, Lyle T. Alverson Professor of Law at the George Washington University School of Law, and moderator for the program. The SEC Historical Society preserves and shares the history of securities regulation through its virtual museum and archive at www.sechistorical.org. The museum is free and accessible worldwide at all times. The virtual museum and archive, as well as the Society, are separate from and independent of the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission and receive no government funding. We thank the many institutions and individuals whose gifts and grants make possible the growth and outreach of the virtual museum and archive, now hosting over 8,000 visitors each month. Today's program is a special broadcast on international financial regulation. We had originally planned to offer an online program on international regulation live from London a little bit later this month. The current financial situation necessitated a change of focus and location for today's program. I'd like to express the Society's gratitude to Mark Berman, a retiring Society trustee, who inspired the idea of a program on international regulation and who will be holding a conference on SEC regulation outside the United States in London later this week. I'm delighted today to welcome two of my colleagues from GW Law School, Lawrence A. Cunningham, the Henry St. George Tucker III Research Professor of Law, and Arthur E. Wilmarth, Jr., Professor of Law. Their remarks today are solely their own and are not representative of the opinions of the Society. They cannot give legal or investment advice. Before we begin, however, I'd like to quote from a Newsweek article written by Fareed Zakaria on February 2nd. He states, "This current crisis has resulted in a deep erosion of American power that we have not fully understood. Even in the depths of the Iraq War, when much of the globe was enraged by George W. Bush's unilateralism, people everywhere believed that the United States had the world's most advanced economy and that its capital markets, in particular, were the most sophisticated and developed. American officials, businessmen, and economists lectured far and wide on the need to copy the American system. That system is now seen across the world as a sham, a casino game in which highly paid participants mismanaged risk and highly respected regulators cheered them on. I have traveled to Europe, Asia, and the Middle East in the past 3 months, and am writing this from Canada. The attitudes of officials and businessmen range from shock to rage at what they see in the United States." Art and Larry, on that cheerful note, welcome.
Great to be here.
Thank you, Teresa.
Now, I'm hoping that one or both of you gentlemen might start us off by describing the state of international financial regulation as it existed, say, 10 years ago.
Well, I think it's certainly been very much a system in process. In many ways, I think international financial regulation in the contemporary sense probably began with the Basel capital regulation accord that was adopted in 1988, really in response to the very serious lending problems that major banks across the world got into by lending to developing countries during the sort of the petrodollar rush days of the 1970s, and then a series of sovereign defaults in the early 1980s, and it became very clear that, in fact, these large banks were holding, you know, very little capital against their risks, and that countries had widely varying notions about how much capital banks should hold. So I think that, to me, I mean, you could go back to Bretton Woods, I'm sure, before that. But I think in the modern sense, it seems to me, Basel represents a watershed because it wasn't so much a series of governments making sort of government-to-government agreements. It was, as some people have said, sort of soft law in the sense that government regulators agreed to adopt these common capital standards. But the banking industry was involved, too, and the banking industry essentially, at least on the face of it, agreed to sort of comply with these standards. And that sort of began the sort of public-private dynamic or interface. I think we've seen it over the last 20 years, for both for good and for ill.
That sounds right to me. I could just add that we've seen in this past decade increasing globalization, capital flowing across borders, and I think 10 years ago the regulatory apparatus didn't necessarily anticipate the significance of these flows or how cross-thatched the financial relationships would be. And so I think 10 years ago you had the sort of the Basel effort and some coordination among securities regulators, some inchoate discussion among accounting standard setters. But I think it was all quite inchoate, informal, and a little bit, if you like, behind the curve. And so there's been a sort of recognition that the international financial regulatory system is probably not as up-to-date or modern as it probably needs to be, given the flow of capital across borders and the significance of organizations, business enterprises, financial institutions that really transcend traditional national boundaries.
Your opening segment, the writer from Newsweek, is sort of interesting because in the 1990s, it was decided that the original Basel Capital Accord wasn't working very well because it wasn't adequately capturing or expressing the risks that banks were taking in increasingly off-balance sheet and exotic and complex ways, and that a new Basel Accord was needed. And that Basel Accord was hammered out eventually in 2004. What's interesting, at least to me, is that, I mean, I'm always a believer that when you point a finger, you know, three fingers are pointing back at you. But the Europeans played a very big role in Basel II and pushed it very hard. In fact, the Americans, many of them were quite skeptical about Basel II. But one could certainly make the observation that Basel II, if anything, gave the large financial conglomerates even greater authority and greater discretion to establish their capital rules and to pursue their various business strategies, and in a sense pushed government regulators back into a more passive role. And that the European banks, in my view, and the UK banks, are just as implicated, just as involved, and just as damaged by this current crisis as the U.S. banks are. So although the particular crisis of which we're speaking may well have started in the U.S. subprime housing market, as it's continuing to unroll and unravel, we see many of the same things, for example, in the property markets in U.K., Ireland, Spain, Eastern European economies, that what you see is this enormous explosion of credit under very reckless circumstances that was fed by the large financial conglomerates and spread around. And as Larry and I were discussing earlier today, that you also have some very interesting overlays between what these large institutions were doing and what the monetary authorities were doing, because there's an interface between how the banks were establishing this credit and also what the monetary exchange ratios look like between the U.S. dollar versus the Chinese yuan versus the Japanese yen versus the euro versus the pound, and I will say that I think the U.S. bears a huge amount of the responsibility, but we don't bear all the responsibility for this disaster. I think the fact that it's a global disaster indicates that there were many players in this particular tragedy, you might say.
That sounds right to me too, and the Newsweek commentator is providing some insight to me too, that if he's really got his finger on the pulse of attitudes in other in other countries, it are probably entirely right that this incubated in different sectors all across the world, and it's sort of in peri delecto, that there are a lot of grounds to point fingers here or there or elsewhere. But it probably remains the case that if the United States enjoyed a reputation as being a leader in effective capitalism with fancy regulators and systemic controls, and that's clearly broken down, even if fault can be shared widely, you know, that perception is probably still a very significant
Right, we were supposed to be held to a higher standard, and what one sees, I think, is that, at least from my perspective, that these giant financial institutions seem to have their way with regulators, at least on the most important ones being Europe, the UK, and here, seem to have their way with regulators no matter what regulatory system or structure was in place. I mean, I think one of the questions that Teresa indicated she might want us to talk about was, well, is one regulatory structure better than another? And part of my response is, well, the outcome seems to have been the same, even though our structure is very different, for example, than UK's, or, and to some extent, different from the Europeans.
You know, it's interesting that when we start to talk about international financial regulation, what we seem to be focusing on first is perhaps the U.S. as one type, another country as another type. Maybe we can back up a little bit and actually see if we can describe what is international financial regulation. What does that really mean?
Well, it's interesting because I think as we've seen so far, there really is no, you know, global interconnected, coordinated system. The Basel Committee is a group of the major central bankers and financial regulators who come together and sort of reach agreements on different protocols and standards and guidelines by consensus. I mean, you could certainly look at the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, but they have sort of relatively confined roles in a more emergency sense, and they really don't have, you know, very many direct impacts on what the major financial institutions are doing in the developed countries. Now, interestingly, some people have argued that maybe we ought to give the IMF, you know, some kind of more direct oversight authority. But I think that's, to me, quite a long shot. So that what you have are a series of sort of conversations and cooperative efforts between regulators here, regulators particularly in the other OECD countries, but it's all done in a sense by consultation and consensus. There really is no well-established framework requiring regulators to act in a certain way, and I think part of the difficulty in responding to the current crisis is that, in fact, the responses from various regulators in various countries has not been the same. There has been, I would say, a fairly high degree of cooperation, but there's also been inconsistency as well. So obviously there have been some discussions about whether we need sort of a more super regulator. You know, that might be something, I think, 10 to 20 years down the road, but depending on whether we're able to surmount the crisis and how we do in solving it, that might lead to some serious thought about whether a more formal type of coordination needs to be established.
Right. And I'll just add, in the spirit of stepping back a little, to think about exactly what we're regulating when we're talking about financial regulation. And obviously, we're talking about markets and institutions that deal with financial matters or financial capital. And one can delineate that to include banking institutions, insurance companies, mutual funds, broker-dealers, maybe even securities markets, futures markets, private pools of capital like hedge funds, and you could delineate it even further. And as Art is saying, there isn't a formal international regulatory apparatus that governs all of that, certainly, and there isn't even anything really fully formed at an international level that formally regulates any of those particular components of the overall financial system. And the global dimensions of this crisis do suggest at least some need to consider the possibility of some more formal coordination. And Basel's a nice sort of inchoate beginning of that, but as Art is explaining, this was a private public partnership that included the central bankers from the G20 or so countries, and banking industry, and I think they succeeded
considerably in trying to develop a definition of capital and a sense of capital adequacy that is quite a feat, given that those notions are contextual and cultural. But really to develop a coordinated international financial regulatory system, probably is 15 or 20 years away, if that. And yet there is considerable interest and current discussion in trying to think about how something might look even sooner. And I think a critical piece of international financial regulation is probably at the central banking organization in any given country. So the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve in the United States, the Bank of England in the United Kingdom, and the European Central Bank in Europe, and their equivalents in a dozen or 20 other leading countries, could begin a process of talking about how to identify financial risks that have potential international implications, just like the ones we were looking at and that Fareed is referring to, and coordinate together to share information about brewing concentrations of financial risk and attempt at least some dialogue and some information sharing to get out in front of those. And then one would have to think about similar elaborations across not just banks, but insurance companies, futures, broker dealers, and so on. So the task, right, of defining international financial regulation in itself is, I think, difficult, and then of actually trying to think about who would participate and how they would coordinate, I think, is a Herculean task, too.
Yeah, I think the AIG crisis is a good example, because here's the world's largest insurance company that basically had a quasi-investment bank, a quasi-hedge fund operating within its umbrella that basically wasn't regulated by anybody. The insurance regulators weren't watching it. The OTS, the Office of Thrift Supervision, here had nominal authority but never looked at it. The Fed had no authority over it. And so it wrote over $450 billion worth of so-called credit default swaps, which essentially were insurance policies, and sold those to financial institutions all over the world, particularly in Europe, to reduce their capital requirements and reliance that it would be able to pay if the underlying credit exposures defaulted. And then, of course, we find that it couldn't pay, and that the Fed has had to pump now up to $170 billion of assistance into AIG, because if it did not, the thought was that the European banks in particular might be suffering, multiples of billions of losses, and maybe even the trillions of losses. So that clearly here was an example where until the AIG problem broke into the open, these interconnections were not understood at all. Or if they were understood, they certainly weren't understood in the magnitude that they should have been. And so I know former Chairman Paul Volcker of the Fed has been talking about the need to have greater transparency and greater oversight of what he would call systemically significant financial institutions, no matter what kind of charter they hold or where they're located. And this may be an area where maybe the central banks need to focus their most immediate attention, is how do we identify those institutions who are either too big or too interconnected to fail without dragging down other major institutions, and how do we get some kind of meaningful control over the kind of risks they're taking?
Right. Just to amplify that point, when Art refers to how AIG was sort of both an insurance company but also had certain features of an investment bank and maybe even a little bit of a commercial bank, this reflects how within the United States the regulatory system tends to be fragmented, so that we've assigned basically on an ad hoc responsive basis regulatory and supervisory authority according to different kinds of businesses that enterprises are in. So states tend to regulate insurance, banking is regulated at both federal and state levels, depending on whether a bank is chartered at federal or state levels. Investment banks had been supervised by the Securities and Exchange Commission. And that kind of fragmentary model certainly has some advantages to allowing different regulators to experiment with different approaches, and maybe to enable one regulator to exert some pressure when another is unable to see something. But there's some clear disadvantages, because there is no single supervisor that can command all information about all of the different financial institutions that participate in the markets, and this can make concentrations of systemic risk invisible to them. And then the problem amplifies when you move to the world stage, where there's functional fragmentation, because United States regulatory authorities may have some capacity to oversee a company like AIG, but not all of its operations, many of which were run in London. And so the Financial Services Authority, the principal financial regulator in the United Kingdom, may have been able to learn something about some of what AIG was doing, but maybe not about everything. And so there's this international fragmentation. And I think Paul Volcker's idea is not only to try to rationalize regulatory oversight within given countries, so in the United States, to enable one senior regulatory authority to oversee a complicated organization like AIG, but then also, and that would probably be something like a central bank in the United States, something like the Federal Reserve, but then likewise to enable central bankers in the other 12 or 20 leading countries to do the same thing, and further to coordinate these 12 or 20 central bankers into something he calls a college of supervisors. And that body would then perform the functions to which you're referring, that try to understand on a global basis where risks are concentrating. And then the central bankers, at a minimum, are able to share information about that. What happens next is unknown. That is, do regulators have authority to instruct firms not to do certain things, or to limit the size of their trading activities, or to maintain a minimum amount of capital? But I think that's the quest that I see, in Paul Volcker's vision, to not only try to concentrate regulatory authority within a senior supervisor in each country, but then to have this sort of horizontal coordination among 12 or 20 leading central banks.
And one of the interesting sort of, I think, sidebars to this story is that the reason that AIG, could do what it did was that there have always been powerful industries in this country who have tried to make sure that the Fed could not supervise them. Okay, one was the insurance industry, another was the thrift industry, a third was the investment banking securities industry. So even though AIG or Goldman Sachs or Morgan Stanley or Merrill Lynch, Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, up until the crisis when they broke out, were all in different ways complicated financial conglomerates with systemic implications, they all operated under loophole statutes that made sure that the Fed couldn't see what they were doing. And it's sort of ironic to me that if not the surface text, at least the implied subtext of the Paulson Financial Modernization Plan was essentially to reduce further the Fed's ability to look at, not only to look at risk, but actually to respond to risk and to take supervisory action, even over major banking organizations. And of course, it was said, well, look what the British had done, because they basically took the Bank of England out of the supervision business completely and left it only as a monetary authority, and rather paradoxically as a lender of last resort, which makes no sense if you have no supervisory authority to go along with it. And they gave all the supervisory authority to the Financial Supervisory Agency, the FSA, and of course we see how well that worked out, with the Northern Rock scandal hit, because the FSA didn't tell apparently the Bank of England how bad things were until very close to the end. And then Bank of England said, well, why should we help out? It's not our problem, and we don't think we should help out anyway for moral hazard reasons. and then the whole thing fell apart. So interestingly, there's been this long debate over the last 15, 20 years about, you know, getting the central banks out of the business of bank supervision or financial supervision generally. But if they're the only ones who can really provide this systemic risk support, you know, through the lender of last resort function, I think this current crisis has shown us that they're not going to be able to do this very effectively, and you'll have just one moral hazard bailout after another unless they can exercise some real supervision, you know, before the crisis hits.
No, I think that's right, too. And the UK model is interesting because it really does tend to concentrate regulatory supervisory authority in a single institution, the Financial Services Authority, and cuts the Bank of England substantially out of that role and remitting it to the sort of the monetary policy function and the lender of last resort function. I think what's interesting about the main proposals that are on the public agenda in the United States, one by Paul Volcker, to which we referred a couple minutes ago, and the one by Henry Paulson, the former Treasury Secretary that Art just referred to, is that both of them seem to imagine something more like what people often call a twin peaks model or a two peaks model. So you'd have two super senior regulators, and one of them would be responsible for systemic stability. And so the Federal Reserve or something like it would be interested in supervising banking institutions, assuring that they are solvent and thrive and prosper and don't need to be bailed out, that the central bank doesn't have to provide that lender of last resort function. And a separate regulatory authority whose mission is to protect depositors and investors and other consumers. And it's really important to have those two separate functions because the interests conflict. If I'm the Federal Reserve, I want my banks to survive and prosper, and that might mean I don't want them paying into a reserve fund or paying restitution or damages. But if I'm the ambassador for the depositors, I want the reserve fund and I want the restitution. And so I think what's nice about the Volcker and Paulson proposals, which are otherwise sort of competitors, is that they both appreciate that the single supervisor model that was really sort of dominant in the United Kingdom, you know, has at least one big problem in it, and that at a minimum the way forward in the United States is to separate those two functions. And I think also, I mean, I think the UK may be learning a lesson. I think the Bank of England and the FSA have functionally renegotiated their powers in the light of Northern Rock and the more recent problems at the other banks, the Royal Bank of Scotland and so on. And the Bank of England is not likely to be content simply providing a lender of last resort function, and it will be more proactively interested in assuring protection of depositors. So there may be some slight emerging consensus that a two peaks model, you know, with some regulatory tension in it, might be important or desirable. Right.
No, this is fascinating because what we seem to be hearing here is that international financial regulation, well, not so much, but at least we can learn from each other's mistakes.
Right. And there's a work in progress, to say the least.
And
right.
Somehow work towards some sort of system of coordination and communication. And I'm curious if there is any answer to the question, suppose someone, some government official in the United States, finds out about a building systemic problem here. Who does he call in the UK, or she call in the UK, or is no call made?
That's a good question. I think it does, you know, call back into mind sort of Larry's point about, well, AIG had these, you know, very big operations in the UK, like many other large institutions. Lehman Brothers had very big operations in the UK, and that's been very much a point in contention in the ongoing bankruptcy proceedings. I mean, at least I cannot speak from personal experience. I always assumed that if the Fed, you know, let's say thought there was a problem here involving Royal Bank of Scotland, or was concerned that there might be a problem in London involving Citigroup, that the Fed would, that the chairman of the Fed or some authorized subordinate would pick up the phone and call someone, most likely in the FSA, although perhaps in the Bank of England, and that they would have conversations. You know, I'm not sure that kind of informal consultation always occurs, but I do get the sense that, you know, since the crisis has broken out, that there has been reasonably good coordination, particularly among the central banks. Sometimes among politicians it's been more difficult, for example, as to what level of fiscal stimulus each country should pursue. There have been disagreements about that. But as to sort of the lender of last resort or emergency liquidity operations of the central banks, there's been quite a high degree of coordination, probably more than we've ever seen before, which I think unfortunately indicates how serious the crisis is, that all the central banks realized that they had to, you know, work together and work together very aggressively.
Yeah, that all sounds right to me. And just to build on that last point, we have witnessed a considerable amount of regulatory reform in the past 8 months. Unplanned, ad hoc, you know, on the fly, on the go, both within the United States and within at least a dozen or maybe more other countries. And as that sort of on the, and the main sort of import of the reform is concentration of regulatory authority across a variety of different financial institutions and types of institutions into a super senior regulator. In the United States, it's mainly the central bank and the Department of the Treasury, or mainly Ben Bernanke and Hank Paulson, until recently, now Tim Geithner. And an equivalent concentration of authority within the United Kingdom in a couple of super senior members of the Bank of England and the FSA. And you see that in a number of other countries. And then simultaneously, the sort of horizontal coordination has begun. I mean, what Paul Volcker is imagining is already, in a certain way, happening. And so I suspect that Ben Bernanke is in... you know, has certain avenues of communication to his counterparts in a dozen or 20 other countries. And, of course, so does President Obama and Prime Minister Gordon Brown, who obviously just spoke the other day, and I think this was a very important part of what they were talking about. And so I suspect we'll have a continuation of this, right, so that the informal channels that have developed, I think, are going to be in place and stay in place.
Well, one of the interesting points, I think that Larry is right, that regulatory reform is happening on the ground and sort of through these emergency ad hoc rescues. But for example, the second Basel Accord is being totally rethought. And it was interesting to see the Swiss Banking Commission come out and say, we're going to reinstitute a leverage capital limit, you know, based on pure, you know, common equity over assets, because we discovered that our two biggest banks, UBS and Credit Suisse, use Basel II and the idea of internal risk-based models and risk-weighted assets to basically slash their effective equity down to under 2%, which in this country would be critically undercapitalized. And, of course, we've discovered in this country that some of our biggest banks, you know, seem to have used similar techniques to get to tangible equity ratios that are certainly in hazardous situations. So the FDIC was the one regulator in this country that kept saying, no, we need a leverage ratio, we need a leverage ratio, we need a leverage ratio. And I think, as Larry indicated, they had the strongest stake in protecting the integrity of the deposit insurance fund. And so that idea is starting to translate elsewhere. And the other thing is this whole idea about transparency. I mean, Larry made a good point about how our markets, you know, have this at least brand or legend of being known as the most transparent markets. Well, that really wasn't true, because we had allowed, you know, $2 trillion of assets to migrate into hedge funds that were completely opaque. And their whole modus operandi was to be hidden from any market oversight or supervision. And I mean, to the SEC's credit, they tried to do something about it, and they got slapped down by the courts when they tried to at least have them, you know, register as investment advisors. And, you know, the Fed had, you know, certainly under Chairman Greenspan, had shown no interest in, you know, getting more transparency out of the hedge funds. And then at the same time, you had this tremendous growth of these over-the-counter, customized, off, you know, off-balance, if not off-balance sheet, at least, you know, opaque derivatives, particularly credit derivatives, which also were not on any exchange, not transparent. And, of course, now with AIG and others, we find, you know, the kind of tremendous exposures that are involved. So one interesting move, which I think hopefully will continue, is, you know, shouldn't we force more of this very high-level economic activity onto organized exchanges where, in fact, market participants as well as regulators can figure out, you know, who's holding what position, what kind of collateral they're holding against that position, whether it's an excessive or, you know, speculative position. The problem was we didn't have any information on any of this until the whole thing began to break down in the middle of 2007. So I'm afraid, you know, that whatever reputation we had for transparency, we essentially lost over the last, you know, 15 years or so.
Yeah, I agree with that, and that might be something that Fareed Zakaria is referring to when he writes that Newsweek article that Teresa quoted at the outset, that was the reputation, or the legend, as Art puts it, and it turns out not to be so. And there was regulatory conspiracy involved in it, too, because as Chairman Greenspan understood this and let it go. And another thing that I see in common between Paulson's proposal, Volcker's proposal, and much of the talk around the world, including by the finance ministers that are members of the G20, who released a sort of communique, a joint expression of commitment to recapitalizing banks and promoting systemic stability and protecting consumers, is precisely a focus on transparency. And throughout all of these markets or sub-markets, making all of these markets as transparent as the traditional securities markets in the United States have been. And so including these credit default swaps and derivative contracts. And I also detect at least a modest consensus among regulators and participants alike in the need to create some form of a public exchange for these sorts of derivatives contracts, probably a proprietary organization based in Chicago and overseen by something like the CFTC or the SEC, but I see a reasonable amount of support for that. I doubt everyone will agree on all the details, but I think transparency is a clarion cry that does seem to command considerable assent within the U.S. and abroad.
And of course, Larry, you've worked tremendously on the whole issue of accounting and whether, you know, we're moving toward, you know, a global accounting accord, but certainly you know, accounting and disclosure are part of that transparency issue. And the question is, you know, do you think we can get there with a set of international accounting standards that might actually provide at least reasonable transparency?
There continues to be considerable enthusiasm among a wide variety of people in the aspiration of having a single, high-quality set of international financial reporting standards. A tremendous amount of work and progress has been made in the last 15 years. There is an existing set of such things that's pretty good. I don't think anyone thinks it's perfect, but it's got a lot to recommend itself. There was an extraordinary amount of excitement about it until a year and a half ago. I think we've now, this episode, the crisis itself, and some of the responses to it have slowed down that momentum a bit. Principally, this slowdown was due to how to value some of these instruments that are very complicated, you know, whose value depends on a lot of different variables, that in a properly functioning market, one might be able reasonably confidently to describe them and assign a value to them and provide some transparent accounting reporting. But in a distressed market, in an impaired market, when no rational counterparty would buy these things, maybe the value is zero. And the accounting standards envisioned measuring the things at whatever the market trading value would be. What in a distressed market, that would be zero. And so there's a considerable controversy about whether this idea of transparency and current value of these things wasn't a culprit in this crisis. Right, right. That if the banks or any holder of assets that are under distress, because the market's under distress, have to write these things down.
It's a downward spiral.
Spiral. So we always joke that every scandal requires an accounting culprit. this one's got fair value accounting. But this is a highly contested issue because right. there's also a case that if it's worth zero, well, we all ought to know that that it's worth zero. And that's the idea of transparency. But it points up to your question some need to continue the dialogue about international financial reporting standards. How did the standard setters respond during this crisis to the pressures that naturally grew up? Were they captured by the banks that they're supposed to just be umpiring? And so I think it's reduced some of the enthusiasm. But there's still serious conversation and work being done. And it's not a bad forum to continue, the question that we began with here about, well, how is international financial regulation different
constructed?
Now, constructed.
Yes.
And that's part of the problem.
One interesting thing about fair value accounting is that it's pretty hard to have fair value accounting if you don't have organized exchanges and if you have opaque assets. And so I remember before the crisis got really bad, I read an article which said that, well, I think that the top five securities firms, most of their so-called fair market value assets were all level three assets, which were, marked to model assets. And so I think fair market value accounting makes a lot of sense to me, but it doesn't seem to work very well if you don't have organized markets and transparent assets. And clearly we tried to do both things at once, which obviously were apparently like pouring oil on water, it seems.
Yeah, the mark to model becomes a mark to myth.
Right,
you're sort of making it up, right? You're imagining, you're constructing a hypothetical market that would exist if
people wanted this
flowing.
Stuff.
Yeah, if people wanted this stuff. Right. No, this is a serious problem. And one of the quips I remember best from this whole crisis occurred in October of 2007 when Ben Bernanke was giving a speech at the Economic Club of New York, and one of the questions from the audience was as a central banker, what information would you like to have that you currently don't have? And his answer was, how do you value these damn things?
Right. Well, that's true. And one of the interesting points we were discussing earlier today was how much of the crisis really resembles sort of Enron on a massive scale, because Enron had all these complex derivatives, all these complex off-balance sheet assets or hidden debts and mark-to-model accounting, which inflated their earnings on the upside, and then once you went down, then it just crushed them. And we don't seem to have learned very much from the Enron episode in terms of how we would avoid doing it on a systemic scale.
Right. I think that's entirely right.
And speaking of the transparency issue, certainly for years we have been hearing about the wonderful transparent American markets. Mm-hmm. But we've also been hearing something about regulatory competition. And there is a price paid for our transparency in terms of the increased cost in raising capital and fear that somehow we're going to lose some sorts of business to oversee regulators who might be more lax. Now, I don't hear either of you now talking about regulatory competition. Is that something that we just aren't going to hear anything about for another few years?
I think one hears about it more in good times. But it is ironic that, of course, the light touch regulator that was held up as the model for all regulators was the Financial Supervisory Authority in England. And they were the light touch regulator. They were the market friendly regulator. They described themselves as such. They advertised themselves as such. And people were very worried about how many, securities listings and IPOs were going to the UK. I haven't done any studies on it, but it amused me that at least I read some articles where a lot of the listings were from internet gambling companies or, Russian companies. It struck me as not necessarily good candidates for American markets anyway. But I've seen some more formal studies where they did not find any you know, any indication that, that New York was about to sort of, you know, have to close up Wall Street. But certainly, it's interesting now if you read the press accounts coming out of the UK, the FSA has announced that they are light touch no more. And if anything, there's been more of a re-regulatory reaction in the UK, partly because their financial sector was even larger as a percentage of their economy than ours is. And so they've suffered proportionally even more than we have. And so light touch is no longer in the vocabulary in London. But I think it does show a danger that there's no doubt in my mind that regulatory competition was alive and well and operating in a very aggressive way over the last 15, 20 years, and that large financial institutions were able to get regulators to do what they wanted. And I could give you a number of examples that would bore you. But certainly the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency advertised itself as the light touch wannabe agency here in Washington, and they were arguing very much for, you know, creation of a treasury-centric bank regulatory role that would get the Fed out of any, you know, supervisory oversight. And as you notice, the success rate of the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency in preventing serious bank problems among their major banks is about the same as the FSA's record. So I would hope the conversation would be over, but I suspect we'll hear it again.
I think you will hear it again, and I think President Obama certainly wants to put an end to it. He last Wednesday at the White House, with his financial advisors flanking him, he announced seven principles that need to guide financial regulation reform. There were seven very simple sentences, and the sixth one was, we can't have regulatory competition. Now, just to come back, so he would like to put an end to it, talk and otherwise. But to come back with that description of the United States regulatory system that I summarized earlier, I call it a fragmentary system, so that insurance is at the state level and futures is at the federal level, securities is a bit of state and federal, banking is federal and state, both, and then there are divisions across the federal government, especially in banking. And there's turf battles between the SEC and the CFTC, and that's and within state corporation law, there obviously there is 50 states from which to choose, and there's some evidence that some states at least like to compete with others. And this is a model of regulatory competition, and as I said before, it has its virtues. It can enable experimentation and require legislators and regulators to compete and to test their policies. And obviously, there's a long-standing debate about whether the result of something like that is a superior regulatory regime or a lax and captured one. But on the challenge, if we when we talk about international financial regulation, is even if we concentrated all of that within the United States into a single consolidated regulatory authority and said, you know, there should not be regulatory competition. So investment banks are going to be subject to some supervision, whether they're under an SEC umbrella or a Fed umbrella or something else, there's going to be a uniform, standardized regulatory framework. The challenge is going to be, will the UK do the same thing and Japan do the same thing so that all G20 countries and maybe more agree that we're not going to compete with each other for regulatory superiority or laxity, but we're all going to have, to use Paul Volcker's phrase again, a sort of a college of supervisors, all of us on the same page. No more. So to take Obama's prescription seriously, that's what you'd need. Not just no regular, right, you know, limited regulatory competition around the United States, but this extensive horizontal coordination and commitment around the world. Now, there may be some difficulty or reason to be skeptical about the sustainability of that kind of model. And certainly talk today tends to embrace coordination, concentration, collegiality, and so on. Whether that will endure when
the crisis goes away,
right, you can start to see, Czechoslovakia wanting to get a little bit of this, or more realistically, Dubai or Hong Kong, and so on. And so, what one does need to think as we design the U.S. system and interface with the others, you know, just realistically, what competition will do. And I think Paul Volcker's vision is that we can create a sustainable, collegial, coordinated group of supervisors. And in contrast, I think proponents of regulatory competition, including Henry Paulson, just don't believe that and think, you know,
the market won't permit it, right?
You know, yeah, you won't permit, yeah, the regulatory market. And so their thought is, their vision is, we can concentrate regulatory authority within the United States, but the purpose of that is to compete with 20 other countries,
right,
not to coordinate with them.
And you look at the various offshore, you know, banking centers, not a surprise that the alleged Stanford fraud would have been, you know, operating out of Antigua or someplace like that. So how do you capture all these small offshore entities, the Channel Islands, the Jersey and Guernsey and so on, Bermuda, you know, who basically their economy depends upon Luxembourg, you know, capturing, you know, bringing big pieces of financial activity to their domain. And, of course, in Switzerland, until recently, promising secrecy. Now Switzerland, because UBS has been so humiliated by their role in tax evasion, Switzerland is sort of having to give way, but to some extent. But yes, I agree with you that arbitrage operates in all markets, except when they're not functioning. Right now, they're not functioning. But when they function again, one would suspect that arbitrage of a regulatory sort would be back.
You've been we've been talking here about the idea that sometimes we hear chit-chat about harmonization, sometimes about competition. If it's on a day or an extended 18-month or longer period in which the focus is on harmonization, do we have to worry about some very basic things as like whether our approaches can be harmonized? Are we, in fact, a more rules-based regime than other countries, which are generally said to be more principle-based? What's that all about, and what do we need to do about it?
Well, I think this is a serious challenge for any vision of harmonization in financial regulation and a lot of other matters of international affairs, because our financial markets and our regulation and our laws are products of our civilization, all cultural features of it. In this context, it includes a litigious culture. We like to litigate. It's, besides baseball, the American favorite American pastime. That has a tendency to create demand for law in the form of clear rules rather than vague general principles, to enable people to create ex-ante defenses. Here is the rule book. We followed it to the letter, and we should be insulated from liability. And so you get a much denser form of lawmaking in this country, in probably all of our fields, but certainly in securities regulation, banking regulation, and accounting regulation. And in other countries, that without that sort of tradition or habit of dispute resolution, there's less demand for that kind of clarity and specificity. Participants may be way more content with broad general principles about what is expected and what is permitted than we are here. A second reason for this difference is, especially in securities context, is that the United States is different from most other countries in the world in the extent to which individual people have stakes in the securities markets. We've always had a strong role of the individual investor, and even today, with the proliferation of mutual funds and pension funds, still a larger percentage of Americans are exposed to the equity markets than in most other countries. And that creates a peculiar cultural environment that manifests itself in rules and in other approaches to regulation that require harmonization. If we were to establish a formal international financial regulatory system, bridging cultural chasms like that or differences like that is a huge challenge. And we've seen it very clearly in the context of developing international financial reporting standards. And you just confront it, I think, at nearly every consequential turn when trying to, you know, generate something that all the participants in the world can assent to.
Early on, we heard a little from you, Art, about public and private cooperation at Basel. And one thing we haven't touched on today is what kind of role there might be for SROs, or self-regulatory organizations, in making things work on an international basis.
Certainly, this idea of a derivatives exchange would be an SRO. And I think that a lot of people believe that if you're going to migrate from totally private and opaque to regulated and transparent, the idea of an SRO is a useful, possibly way station, possibly stopping point, depending on how well they work. I think the Public Certified Accounting Oversight Board that came out of Sarbanes-Oxley is another good example. I mean, there was a totally private profession that was entirely disgraced by what happened during the late 90s and the turn of the century. And, Congress could have decided, okay, let's make them entirely like, a regulated utility, but instead set up essentially a self-regulatory organization with, obviously, SEC oversight. Larry would say better, much better than I, but my sense is the PCAOB has been quite successful, that I think that there is virtue in not, turning everything into a regulated agency or a regulated utility, I would certainly be very prepared to see. I could imagine you could imagine sort of an SRO approach for hedge fund type entities that were marketing their investments primarily to what we would consider accredited investors, but we're not content simply with allowing them to be complete black boxes. So I think SROs may be a useful way of sort of bringing things out of the shadows and into more of the daylight, but maybe not going completely toward an entirely top-down government-regulated approach.
That sounds right to me, and I concur in celebrating the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board, this self-regulatory organization that Sarbanes-Oxley created. Certainly, it has had its critics at occasional turns. It may have gotten carried away with one or two of the standards that it initially adopted. Sometimes the auditing firms don't like how intense their inspections are or how deep into minutia the board gets when it inspects the firms. But I think on balance, people appreciate that it's contributing a lot. And indeed, one notes that in the current crisis, auditing firms have not been held responsible for anything. I mean, obviously, there are deep pockets and a few lawsuits, but they don't seem to be engines or drivers of the crisis. And there's a chance that the Sarbanes-Oxley Act and the PCAOB have something to do with that. The other thing I'd say about self-regulatory organizations is that they come in such a wide variety of flavors and forms. I mean, PCAOB is a very interesting specimen created by Congress. The New York Stock Exchange is a very different kind of one. The FINRA, the sort of broker-dealer enforcement apparatus, and the Futures Industry Association is interesting. But they can be, I think, very useful. You get expertise, you get contact with the most important participants in the market, and it may even be a way to make horizontal global coordination work so that super senior regulators can all get together in a single room and agree on a lot of stuff, but then delegate to the SROs in their countries a lot of the day-to-day stuff.
Art and Larry, thank you for sharing your insights on international financial regulation. Today's program is now added to the growing number of materials on international securities regulation already in the museum collections, particularly the Imperial SEC Gallery, written and curated by Dr. Felice Batlin of Chicago Kent Law School, the April 22, 2008 Fireside Chat on the work of the SEC Office of International Affairs, the transcript of Beyond Borders, A New Approach to the Regulation of Global Securities Offerings, which was the subject of the Society's 2007 annual meeting, and interviews with Michael Mann, Robert Strahota, and Ethiopis Tafara, current or former staff of the SEC Office of International Affairs. Today's program can be accessed again on demand in the online program section of the museum in MP3 and transcript format. Next month, the Fireside Chats will return with the April 21st program on the SEC Office of the Chief Accountant with John Albert of the SEC staff and Gary Previtz, professor at Case Western University. The chat will be free and accessible worldwide without prior registration. Please plan to join us again on www.sechistorical.org on April 21st. Thank you for being with us today.